countries that are not so neoliberalized.
Michael, did you not, in a previous conference, show that the real estate taxes had been lessened? The people had to pay more taxes and the real estate...
States and municipalities are now, as you know, in this country, basically broke. And one of the reasons they're broke is because of their pension funds. The government is saying, quite correctly, you can't pay the pension funds that you promised. And that's because they've all been based on this fictitious idea of capitalization, that all you have to do is put money in a pension fund at 8% interest rate. Now, by the rule of 72, 8 goes into 72, 9 years, the theory was that the pension fund money was going to double every 9 years and you'd make it all over capital gains. What they didn't say is that all these capital gains would be debt financed, and what goes up really is the debt, not the money in the pension funds, because they've been all run by not the most honest people in the money managers. I say that as a former employee of Scudder, Stevenson, Clark. I've worked for money manager companies, which is the most honest company that I could find, and I think it's the most honest company on Wall Street among the bankers. But that's really the problem. There's a loss over what used to be moral philosophy, and Nick, for instance, has been pushing economics to recover the moral philosophy aspect that it used to have. I think that the man who talked after me from the Federal Reserve talked about the moral hazard, and I think you should realize what moral hazard is to the wealthy. To the wealthy, the moral hazard is that society may enact an economy, an economically moral system that will get rid of the free lunch that they extract. That's their moral hazard. And I think that's the moral hazard that we on the podium here are all trying to promote. That doesn't answer his question, but that's what I can do.
Well, I guess my short version of your answer is that if there's any hope at all, it would be to introduce land value taxation.
Yes. And that is a precondition. You can the best way to ensure financial reform so that the banks don't create credit against property is for the tax system to be based on the economic rent tax. Not only for land value, but for economic rent extracted by infrastructure, by utilities, and by the banking system, which is the economic rent of the privilege of credit creation.
And minerals.
And minerals, absolutely. Minerals.
And fishing rights.
And fishing rights.
And absolutely. The spectrum.
Absolutely right. The spectrum, especially. Absolutely right. Now, that's the way we should be going.
And now I'm going to put a contrary point to those previous 2 points, because particularly speaking from the Australian experience, if you do that, you give the government a vested interest in trying to increase the value of land, because that's where their tax revenue comes from. And this is what's happened in my country quite outrageously, that the land bubble we've had down there has largely been promoted by the government deciding to boost the economy occasionally by stimulating speculation in land. Now, they called it giving money to first-time buyers so they can buy properties more cheaply. But, of course, what they then do is take that extra grant from the government, go to a bank, multiply it by 10 with the leverage banks will give them these days, and speculate up the price of the property. And that works doubly for the government because, A, it's a short-term macroeconomic boost that makes them look like they know how to run the economy. And secondly, they then get revenue at the other end because that increase in land price turns up as increases in stamp duty revenue and so on. So they get a vested interest in enhancing the role of the speculators, which is what we're trying to get rid of in the first place. So for that reason, I don't think that's the solution. I think what you've got to do, and this is why I'm not a complete fan of the proposals of the American Monetary Act, what you have to do is eliminate the possibility of leverage speculation in the first place. If you don't do that, then when you set up a system which is designed to get government revenue out of that speculation, then the speculation will start once over again, and you'll have the state having an interest in maintaining it, and we'll be back where we are again on another podium in 2050 or 2060.
I'd like to reply to that by saying that I agree that it's important that we not have leveraged speculation, and I think that the best way to do that is to have even higher taxes on land. If land is taxed sufficiently highly, there won't be any land value to speculate on.
He's right.
Yeah, you'll be right in 2010 or 2020, slightly less right in 2025, 2030, 2035, 2040, as the state slowly winds back the level of land tax.
No, because don't wind it like that.
You're saying don't, Michael. Okay. I'm saying they will. I mean, I think this.
But you should distinguish between economic feasibility and political feasibility.
No, you shouldn't. You should. If you don't have it politically feasible, it'll fall apart.
That's why Chinese invented gunpowder.
but in Tiananmen Square, they aimed it. They aimed it at the peasants in Tiananmen Square. Well, the peasants aimed it at the students in Tiananmen Square. Ultimately, the state will have an interest in unwinding that system. And if you have to find a way to stop it building up in the first place. So I think, okay, yes, sure, put high land taxes inside there, et cetera, et cetera. But if you don't change the nature of capital assets, the way we define them, so that you make it much less feasible to make the profit in the very first instance, then the power of what will be the reduced power of landed interests and banks in the aftermath of a crisis like we're in now, if we actually solve the crisis, will become a growing power over time, as it did from 1945 on. And you'll be back in the same situation in 50 or 60 years. So I'm afraid that I see the ideas to control the system by taxation or regulation will ultimately lead to a state unwinding those, because the power of the groups you're trying to control will rise. They'll capture the regulators once more, they'll capture the legislature once more, and those things will be unwound over time and you'll be back where you started again.
This is a theory that Jamie Galbraith has just put forth in The Predatory State. Mm. The predatory state isn't the socialist state, it's a state where the financiers take over. Mm. That's what you have to fight against.
Yeah.
Yeah, I may need to think about this a little bit more, but I think with the American Monetary Act, and you stop the leveraging of credit by banks, I think this will control a lot of what's been discussed here. They won't have the opportunity to do that.
For example, could the...
Yeah.
If you look at the recent obvious cause of the crisis, real estate lending, had there not been this power in the hands of the banks, could this have developed in that way? Is that...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's correct. It will remove the leverage initially, but if you still make it possible for banks to finance that landed speculation, then they'll set off a bubble, and the bubble will lead to a recession when it stops. And in that process, they'll say, who's responsible for this crisis? It's the fact that you handed over the control of credit, which should be something the private sector runs, to a bunch of incompetent government officials. We need to go back to the previous system. But this is the danger. If you look at the history of reform, and this is putting it in a very Heimiskian way, if reform succeeds, it'll be abolished. Okay. The Glass-Steagall Act, which put that barrier up between the wholesale banks and the retail banking sector, was abolished because it succeeded. It succeeded in temporarily reducing the volatility caused by the financial sector and gave you that period of tranquility from the end of the Second World War through to the mid-1960s. And then from that stage on, because it was still possible for that shadow banking system to finance speculation, you had a growing level of speculation over time, growing level of debt, the volatility that gives you, the transfer of wealth from the working class across to the financial class, bypassing the industrial capitalists, as we've seen both economically and in the model I've shown you earlier. And ultimately, they had sufficient strength to argue in 1999 for its abolition. And I think probably the most embarrassing thing Bill Clinton ever did had nothing to do with the cigar and Monica Lewinsky. It was standing up there and saying what a great thing it was to abolish the Glass-Steagall Act.
Yeah.
Okay. That will happen to your act if you're not careful.
Sticking on that point, since Glass-Steagall was a piece of legislation, you know, and even more than regulation, can you explain to me why it is that you have confidence that what the proposal that you're making, which is to say that we're going to restrict the investment, to non-speculative investment, is not a statutory or a regulatory fix that won't be undone over time in the same manner as every other regulation that we've ever had?
Yeah, that's the I agree. That's always a possibility, and I'll talk. Well, I think mine's slightly less likely to be termited. I'm not saying it won't be termited. Any other systems which still enables profit to be made by leverage speculation will mean those profits are made initially by the financial sector. So as soon as you abolish, bring in some change like your act, they'll start building up financial power out of the fact they can successfully fund speculation. What I'm trying to do initially is say that it's so bad, so unlikely to make profit from that activity, that they don't build up that power in the first place. And on the other side, so if you remember, my idea was that shares should be redefined so that a share lasts indefinitely if you buy it from the company, so it's issued from the company, and therefore the money you hand over, whether leveraged, you know, borrowed money or your own money, goes to a company with an investment plan. And that's also industrial capital, not financial capital, goes to that plan. Then you are building productive capacity by handing over that money. Then it goes to the secondary market. If it's sold on the secondary market, then it lasts, say, 50 years, and it expires with zero value. It makes it much less likely people are going to accept debt from banks to speculate on the value of secondary assets. Whereas at the moment they do that, and under your act they can still do that, accept the money from a bank and speculate on secondary assets and make a profit. And the banks, of course, get the revenue out of that. They grow, and then their power rises. So I'm trying to find a way to stop their power rising in the first instance. I agree if I don't succeed in stopping the power rising in the first instance, it'll be back in the same situation again anyway. And another idea, the reason behind the real estate concept, which is to say that leverage against property should be limited to, say, to 10 times the rental income of the property. A large idea of that, behind that again, is to actually build a landlord class. I'm waiting for Michael's ears to prick up here. Okay, but I want a landlord class that makes money out of renting properties to people who don't own them, out of the rental flow, and that's only feasible if the price of the land in the first instance is low enough that they can do so. So I want a class that has an interest in keeping the prices down.
That's what China tried to do in turning over property to developers and asking for 80 years of the rent in advance, and they could only charge a dollar or two because they wanted to leave more money in the hands of developers. So what they called rent actually was simply a transfer of title, and they don't have a land tax there. So that only works if you have a land tax, and ultimately you have to educate the population as to how the economy works so that they understand this. If you don't educate the population, they will become a sucker for exactly what Steve is talking about.
Mm. Well, I certainly was proposing the Chinese reform. Say, limit the leverage. Let private ownership continue, but limit the leverage with which you can buy something as a private owner to 10 times the annual rental of the property. And that then, I hope, would work. So I agree they're quite feasible that they could be overturned, but there's advantages over the... They're tiny reforms in one sense. It'd be very, very easy to bring those in and lock them in too. You could put them in the Constitution if you could get them in there. They don't require a whole regulatory regime. They don't require the paraphernalia of the state to anything like the level that a proposal like the American Monetary Reform does. And that, to me, is a good thing because, again, we've seen what regulators do. They turn into compradors with the people they're supposed to control.
Mm-hmm. Getting back, again, to the American Monetary Act, I really don't worry that much. You're bringing up a theoretical problem which might occur, but there are a lot of reasons to think that it won't occur. And the first one is that if this act can pass, and we're a long way from there now, it'll require more crisis, it'll require much more education. Passage of this act will signal such a dramatic shift in power in this country that the people that you're worried about are going to be a lot more worried about keeping some part of what they have. This is the way I look at it. I'm thinking of the great German hyperinflation, which was done, by the way, by a private central bank under private control, private ownership, and yet governments are blamed for that, and it's always, not always, but often given as a reason why you see governments can't handle this. And the phrase that came out of that in reestablishing a monetary system there, the German government retook control through Schacht. And the action, the very first action that was necessary, was to crush the speculators, which he did, and was easily able to do because they had wrecked the whole currency. So I think we're going to be in a position with the amount of information that would have gotten out, the amount of education that would have been done, the amount of political organizing that would be done by the time this act passes, that it's just the first step. It's only the first step. We know how little power we have. We know that. We know how much power the banking establishment has. Just look around. They've gotten bailed out for a problem they caused while the people are suffering. We're applying just a tiny part of what they got to, for example, a citizen's dividend, as in Title V or Act, the recession would be over. So we know how much power they have. Our strategy has always been the same, for 10 years anyway. Get the minimum reforms needed to put time on the side of justice. You don't stop reforming at that point. You got the minimum reforms to move forward. And I really can't see a way that bankers are going to regain power anytime soon. And if they do, what's the worst result is we end up where we are now. Didn't lose anything.
That sounds like the life. If we're saying, is this on? Let's see.
Yeah.
Okay. That sounds like. Is this on? I can't.
No.
Okay.
Just try this.
Okay, can I? Yeah. Okay, can I just make a quick comment? Then I better hand it to somebody else. Okay, sure.
Professor Keene makes a good point. If you look at the history, and Steve knows this, and I know this, this thing has gone back and forth. And I think I used a description in my talk that the money power is like a spring. And if you don't keep the force on it, it'll come back. Obviously, the Monetary Act isn't the only thing we need to do. And Steve's already made the point. If you don't stop the damn speculation, you're not going to stop anything.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I think back to your just coming to your comments, Stephen. I think it's a bit like the Life of Brian. Remember that one on the crucifix? What you lost? You got nothing. You got nothing. What you lost? Nothing. I'd rather get slightly closer to Nirvana than the Gethsemane Hill. So that's why I'm thinking about. And your point is quite correct that they come back, Bob. You know,
yeah.
I think I wouldn't call them a spring of zombies. You know. Kill them, but I've got to make them only a small number of zombies. You don't want them to get the overwhelming groups they come back to these days. So, yes, okay. I'm not arguing against the Reform Act, but I'm saying put into it something that redefines capital assets
as well. Tell us what to put in, and we'll
those are the two things. Make shares on the secondary market last a defined length of time, and then they expire, and limit the amount of money that many can be leveraged against property to 10 times the rental of the property. Whack that in there as well.
Well, I would take a somewhat different approach. I think that what we're looking for could be described as a moral reform. And there are some moral reforms that have lasted. And the reason they last is because there has been a change in human consciousness. I think the two most important moral reforms we've seen in the past few centuries are, first, the end of slavery. Nobody anymore defends slavery. And the second is the understanding that women and minorities have to have the same political and civil rights as majority males. Nobody disputes those things anymore. We've had a change in moral consciousness. And I think that we need to organize this movement in such a way as to achieve the kind of change in moral consciousness that would make backsliding impossible.
You're right about potential backsliding. And if you want to know how it would happen, just this will tell you how. It's Kotlikoff's book, everyone's hearing about him. Nick is right, he stops some parts of bank risk, but he opens the door wide for speculation. Like a feast for the speculator. He wants insurance speculation. He wants you to be able to do all, you know, I think actuarials would go out of business. He doesn't need them. You know, the market will decide those. So there's got to be a realization that markets are limited.
And the moral part of this is so important.
Yeah.
Can I add something too, just as far as the moral consciousness? And I know Professor Hudson is, I've learned a lot here in the last 3 or 4 years, has always talked about the free lunch. And I guess you referred to that book last, was it Jonathan Cook or whatever? And I think, David K. Johnston, yes. And if we could, the moral, and this is the stuff I always hear, and this is what changed my attitude, because I'm a professional and I work my ass, you know, the usual thing. And I'm not going to let that welfare mama, and I'm not going to let this person, and, you know, I'm going to have, you know, all this crud that we get. And if, I know, Michael, are there any figures where we could say the people who have the free lunch, which is welfare, by the way, and all the other essential, what I consider necessities, which is on the third part of the monetary reform, and that's infrastructure for education, so that our engineers and everybody aren't going to the finance sector. They'll learn how to make better cars and whatnot, and so that your education, the infrastructure, and whatnot. Are there any way we could just, you know, everybody likes to throw out so much percent watching too much CNN or some of the business stuff on Fox, but is there any way we could come up with something?
Let me try an answer first, Michael. Whenever I hear people talking about the welfare mothers and the free lunch, I think that from my perspective, I think we ought to recognize that there is a free lunch in the economy, and the free lunch is rent. It's the return to things that nobody made. And I think it's very unfair to force the rich to bear all the burden of having this money that they didn't make. I think it's much fairer to spread around the burden of the free lunch equally among all of us.
Nick's right, it is possible to quantify the free lunch, and on my website I have the recommendations I made last week down in Brazil that they recalculate the national income, the way in which the national income statistics are presented, to divide the economy into economy number one, which is a production and consumption economy, and economy number two, which is the rent extraction economy, basically the FIRE sector, finance, insurance, and real estate. Right now, there's an inversion of the traditional moral classical idea, and I think you can see it. David Kelly would have told me about the charts he would have done, I would have explained to him how an economist thinks about these things. That's rather different. He talked about the income of the 13,400 households equaling what the bottom 90% of households made. The definition of productivity in the American economy is in the numerator. You have the income the bottom 90%, 98% make, or the total GDP. In the denominator, you have the 13,400 families. So the 13,400 families produce the whole GDP. You should track productivity in terms of this increase in GDP relative to what the 13,400 households produce. If you do that, you'll see an enormous growth of productivity, which essentially is the free lunch. The productivity in the American statistics is the rate at which the free lunch is being created. And a good national income and product account would show this. Easy to do. If I could have a few days with a Excel statistician, I could produce these figures.
Have you heard of the barefoot economist, somebody from Chile?
Barefoot economist. I think I have, but I forgot what it is. I'm 71 years old. My memory isn't what it used to be. Oh, that's right. That's right. Amy did it, of course. That's right.
Down and roll up your sleeves and maybe spend an internship for some
The funny thing, I spend some time in Eastern Europe, and I'm told that over this economic devastation that's occurring, Eastern Europe and the economies that have been through half a century of an economy that doesn't work will be doing the best, because they're very adept at already getting by. The Eastern Europeans have their dachas, for most of them grow their own food on their own family plot. They're probably going to be okay. It's the interconnected economies like America that are not going to be, when they can't get their food-like substances anymore.
I have a question. I work in technology, and I'm a systems application designer. So, and I know that you can, they're always fiddling with systems, you know. So from the point of view of the AMI strategy, what Stephen says about this is the first step makes sense to me, because things will be fiddled with, you know, but at least this will be better. But it seems to me that the most important thing, and it goes back to the moral, I guess, but even beyond that, which is educating people, because if you go back to the revolution, you know, an educated citizenry is the one who's going to stop the little fiddling with, that's going to give the power back. So I just want to say I think that's probably the critical piece long term.
I'll make a comment on that, and that is that education is a tricky thing. There's so many different ways to educate people. It's not just education. It's critical thinking. It's learning how to see through bad arguments and see, think for yourself and figure out what the right answer is. That's the kind of education that's needed.
I appreciate the distinction between income earned during off of rents and other types of enterprises, but it seems also that almost anything you could mention, including, say, oil extraction, there's a mixture between the labor involved in producing that that income and the actual capital or wealth behind that. So, for instance, if you have an oil rig in a place where you can get oil for $1 barrel in Saudi Arabia, there's essentially nothing. There's no labor involved in extracting that. But somebody in the oil industry would say, hey, we spend $20 a barrel, and it's a very difficult technical enterprise to extract oil, and it's not totally just you know, making all of this money off of extracting resources for nothing. I mean, it's not it's not an argument that I particularly subscribe to, but how would you respond to this, that there's nothing, that you can't really categorize it as pure rent-seeking behavior, or, you know, how do you make those conceptual distinctions? Okay.
Well, you're right about that, and figuring out how to collect the rent off of mineral extracting activities is one of the most difficult conceptual problems in collecting rent. And the best you can hope for is some kind of approximation. Mason Gaffney has done some nice work on the theory of it. In theory, what you want is the combination of a property tax on that is a tax according to the value of the asset for access to it, combined with a severance tax on how much value you take out of it. But it's hard to figure out exactly what the magnitudes of those taxes are. We could describe it in theory how to do it, but coming up with the accounting equivalents in a real world is tricky, and so we have to come up with the best approximation, and it's not going to be perfect.
Yeah, the issue of the moral consciousness change has a distinctive difference in this case as compared to some of the past in this last century or so. There's a lot of gray area within this particular area of reform, whereas it's literally black and white in the others. I mean, if you're actually talking about someone's color of their skin. So that opens up the area for possible manipulation back and forth into the policies. And that also brings the necessity for this particular reform to be coupled by even stronger levels of educational awareness of knowing the dynamics of actually what's going back and forth and the reasons that people might have to implement changes for whose benefit, for their own, for public good benefits. And
okay, let me respond to that. I understand the question. And what I would say is that even with something as black and white as slavery, there are some gray areas. Is a system of military draft an example of slavery? Is it slavery to put people in prison? Is it slavery to put people in mental asylums when they don't think they're mentally sound? I would say that we need to make those distinctions while adhering to the principle that slavery is wrong. In the same way, with respect to the monetary system, the general principle that I think we might possibly get agreement on is that the things of value that no one made should be shared equally. And then how we turn that into practice is a bit of a difficult thing, and there are gray areas. But if we could get agreement on the principle, then I think we wouldn't have nearly so much trouble, just as we have an agreement on the principle that slavery is wrong, and somehow or other we manage to deal with the areas that people might consider gray.
Right, I appreciate that, and I can even see the current system even being a more obscure extraction from slavery as well, if you look at it in terms of the way we treat each other. And I like the idea of digging in a lot of different areas and going deeper and deeper and finding more solid policies. And I liked Dr. Keene's 50-year expiration share idea. And I was wondering if you even considered that how easily perhaps that could be turned around and said, hey, this is limiting business expansion. We're suffering and we need more investment.
Well, then in that case, let's see. I think it actually would. I think it actually would do the opposite, because if you actually made it impossible for people to get unearned, and I agree entirely with the concept about making it raising the moral standard that things that are unearned should be shared equally, and getting away from the fact that people actually, the main activity people have these days in the finance sector is getting as much unearned income as possible, because they call it something different, but that's what they're doing. It would be. If you actually brought in a system where shares expired after 50 years, then it wouldn't be the people who are trying to make large amounts of unearned income who are buying shares in the secondary market. You'd not be buying shares in the secondary market effectively as an annuity to give you an income stream over time. It would actually mean people who are trying to find that unearned income would be forced to hand it over to people doing actual investment. So I hope what would happen is you'd have a dramatic increase in the status and role of the primary issuing market and a diminution in the role of the secondary market, and that therefore would probably mean a higher rate of growth rather than a lower rate of growth. But if I put that in context, I don't believe we can continue growing as we are on this planet. I believe we're seriously hitting our ecological constraints. So this is only one of many issues we're facing, and those are the ecological is overweening above the top of that. But to redirect the investment that is done towards productive activities, because given the fact we're in a planet that desperately needs to redesign how it produces things, we need more money going there than going into speculation. That's been a huge distraction. So I think the reform of saying shares expire after 50 years would potentially increase the rate of capital formation at a time we need it, and just have that sustained effect, and therefore make it much harder for people to say, oh, we shouldn't be giving as much money for creating capital. Let's give more money for speculating on it instead. That's a bit harder argument to make, I hope. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the thing about education too, and I agree again that it has to be critical education. As I've been saying in my talk here, I think we've all fallen for the myth about how money is created in the current system called fractional reserve banking. When you look empirically, that's not what's happening. And so you're trying to reform something that doesn't exist, which is a dangerous first step. And that's a case where the critical thought is necessary to say, well, what actually is the way that this thing seems to operate? Not just taking the prayer books and catechisms from the Federal Reserve and how it happens, which are plausible, but impact empirically can't be how things happen. So you need that critical education as well. But for the long term, I'd like the financial sector to be something people don't have to think about. We've got nothing else on our minds apart from thinking about how finance works.
Steve, what name would you give to the way the system currently works?
Endogenous credit creation.
Okay.
That's the system we have. And again, that beautiful quote that Basil Moore located, and I found the original document as well, from 1970. Basil published a paper in 1979. I think the Federal Reserve conference where that statement was made was back in about 1977. And that was that what actually happens is banks extend loans, creating deposits in the process, and look for the reserves later. And that's a very succinct statement of what actually empirically happens. Now, that's how the money's created. And if you say, well, it's fractional reserve banking, that's the evil, in a sense, you're saying, it's your myth that's evil. I'm sorry. It's the practice of endogenous money creation, which is essentially how it has to happen.
When you say endogenous,
I mean the financial system creates credit, its capacity to do that is not controlled by a reserve system.
It means that the credit creation does not come from depositors supplying what banks lend out. That's what happens in financial intermediaries in the savings banks that I described earlier today. It means the banks create it exogenously to the real economy, endogenously to itself.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I agree that natural resources should be shared. That's why we went over to Iraq to get our oil, was trying to hog it up. I jest, of course. But I think you just made the point I was going to make, that we've got to reform the monetary thing first, and this great privilege that's been handed to a select few people to plunder the rest of us. That's the first step.
Whether it's called fractional reserve or not.
Mm. Yeah, I don't care what you call it.
Just a follow-up question then. Who do you think should be responsible for creating credit, and who should get the benefit of creating that credit?
I think Michael and I might be in a bit of a... I'm guessing Michael's going to agree with the statement I'm making here. It's not so much that who creates the credit, it's what the credit's used to do. And if you enable credit to be used to fund unproductive activities, speculation rather than production, that's the core problem. So if you reformed the system to, say, the state created the credit, which is what your system would actually do, and then that credit was used by the banks to finance speculation and assets rather than actual production, it would work for a while for the speculators, cause a financial crisis when it busted. It would always bust because you're adding debt for unproductive reasons. Then lead to a financial crisis, which would be blamed by the banks on the system you put in place, and that'd be the first step in unwinding what you brought in. Michael, I better you say whether you agree with me or not on that.
Yes, I agree with you.
Yeah.
Well, let me have a word first, Steve, and then I look at it somewhat differently. I think that I agree with a lot of what he says, but I want to concentrate on the question, which is how should credit be created? And my answer, perhaps you already know this, is that you would have an entity somewhat like the Fed, which would decide every week how much money to put in everybody's bank account. And that we would create money by just passing it out equally to everybody. And then people would, if they wanted to invest, would invest in mutual funds, which would make loans out of the money that they had on hand.
Well, the first disagreement I have with all three of you economists is the following. You're using the term credit, and we prefer the term, in our word, what we're trying to do, we prefer the term money. Mm. And it's an important distinction. But economists will always talk about credit because that's, the tradition that they've been brought up in. Michael is aware of this, I know, because...
I think we should compromise. We'll call it debt. Debt creation. That's really what you're creating.
No, not creating debt.
I know you don't agree with that.
We're creating money. Yeah, money as distinct from credit debt.
It's now a few thousand years since the double entry bookkeeping was developed. Any asset on one side of the balance sheet involves a debt on the other side of the balance sheet. It's necessary to put what we're discussing in an accounting format, and you've got to use a balance sheet accounting. The net worth is on the liability side of the balance sheet. So we're talking about net worth. It may not be debt that's expected to be repaid, but it is on the liability side of the balance sheet. And I think if you focus on debt instead of credit, you will then focus on the problem that what is being created is a vast increase in debt beyond the ability to pay.
Okay, well, so let me reply to that
first. Yeah. Not working.
I would like to reply to that. I'm fine with talking about creating money. I think that is a better term than creating credit. If I said credit, I retract that and I'll say money.
We're
but okay. But I also want to say that I think that what Michael says is interesting because there is an aspect of my thinking that relates to the idea of creating debt, and that is that I have a view that we should share equally the seniorage, that we should put the same amount of dollars into everybody's account when we create money. and that there is a form of debt that goes with this, and that is the obligation to turn those dollars back in again if we ever find that we need to get by with less money in order to avoid inflation. So I would say that that is the other side of the double bookkeeping entry to the system. But
yeah, another question really. Have you, and it's also a question for Professor Yamaguchi, have you ever analyzed how the system would work with full reserves, with investment coming from real savings? So, has anybody analyzed how the system would work with full reserves and investment coming from real savings? So in order for investment to be made, somebody somewhere must give up their money for a period of investment. Have you looked at that?
Not really, but my model can explain, as you said, that whenever someone creates assets, that becomes someone else's debt. So in terms of the definition of money, the money have to be under the monetary form have to be more tangible object. Meanwhile, credit is an intangible number, so we have to clarify. We call it savings or credit or whatever. But the debt and asset is just accounting way to classify. So it doesn't. It's not to the point. The only point is whether we can really use the tangible or money. No one can create the number figure. So that's only a distinction. And did I?
Yeah.
It could treat it as income if necessary, rather than as a balanced.
Do we have to be stuck with an accounting convention called double entry?
Exactly. Wow.
That's how nature works.
An accountant. Think of the money as carrots.
We don't run a double entry book system when we take things out of the ground and use it. And that may be a flaw in the system. And if we did it that way, we might understand better where we are.
Can I respond to that? To this, I've read the Act, and I've been thinking about, since Steve Keen has brought up endogenous money creation, and I get that. And so I apply it to the Act, and it can happen in the following way, as the Act is written right now. In the Act, the government can choose through the Monetary Control Board, choose to lend money to the banks, which they can in turn lend to their customers. If, in the endogenous process, the bank just keeps borrowing or lending at a higher interest rate as fast as they can, and they hope to have a conduit going from a corrupted Monetary Control Board that Steve's surmising that it could happen in time, and so that the money just keeps flowing, and that there's then less money for the government to spend into circulation and more money increasingly for the private sector to loan in at a higher interest rate and become the rentier class again. One of the things, though, when you look at derivatives and what's going on with consolidated debt obligations is the selling of mortgages by the banks to investors. If you had a stipulation in there that a bank, commercial banks, had to keep their loan portfolio and they couldn't, I don't know why not 100%. If you look at savings and loans and how they started in the early 19th century, they had the good purpose of wanting people to get homes, and they would work out schemes, various types of schemes, so they could get homes. And you'd have the money to build your home, and that money, as you paid it back, would circulate around, and it would accumulate in this the savings and loan that was started, so the next person could get their house built. In that system, you kept your loan portfolio. It didn't grow. And so if you need new investment, you have other investment vehicles, But as you've been well pointing out, the mortgage market might be a little more sacred, something close to a public utility. You need your home, shelter, and clothing. If you want to invest in Apple or Microsoft, that can be different. And you can, any thoughts on this?
Well, yeah. I have to say something legally about that. My first job on Wall as an economist on Wall Street was as the economist for the Savings Banks Trust Company. What you're describing, I think most people think, really was savings banks, where there is a deposit that's guaranteed. SNLs did not take deposits and lend them out for building. SNLs were different from the savings banks. The depositors didn't have a bank deposit; they had a share,
right.
People were called putting. You would have a share, so if the value went up or down, the share value would go down. That was changed in the 1970s to put SNLs on a par with savings banks so they could be destroyed and turned into commercial banks for Wall Street to rape.
Right.
You have to be very clear about that. And this goes back to the discussions at the beginning of the 19th century by Saint-Simon in France. And the Saint-Simonian said the way to make a banking system without debt, if you're talking about debt-free money, is to have the financial system based on shares. And the ideal of the Saint-Simonians was to create banks as essentially mutual funds, and this became the first foundation of the Société Générale that the Perrier brothers created in France. Ultimately, it went under because this was done under Napoleon III, and the government got a hand in all of this and perverted it into promoting government projects. Much like I'm told the Japanese Postal Savings Bank has been used to fund the corrupt ruling party of the Japan as a kind of political patronage. So you need all sorts of checks and balances, but I would much prefer to see the banking system return to a mutual fund basis of making shares, not debt. There is a way to get debt-free money, that was a Saint-Simonian. Marx was a Saint-Simonian. The socialists were Saint-Simonian in the 19th century. This was the classical economic idea of financial reform. And so you really need three things. You need a financial restructuring. You need what Nick's talking about, a fiscal restructuring, so there will not be the economic rent to be capitalized into bank loans. And you need a general public understanding, as the woman in the back had said, understanding of how the process works to prevent all of this. One part of the reform alone won't work. The tax reformers haven't worked because they haven't seen the financial dimension of this. The financial reformers need to see the others. You need a three-part approach to the whole topic in order to make it work as an economic system. You can't take one organ of the economic system and hope that'll work without changing all of the other organs to make a
I agree, and that's why I went back to when I mentioned early 19th century savings and loans. And in the American Monetary Act, if you're dealing with quote-unquote real money, can government can hold the line on how much endogenous money is created through the American Monetary Act if you can limit...
It wouldn't be endogenous under the Act. As I understand what Steve said, the government would supply banks with... the money that they would then lend out, and they would owe the government.
I'm upset with the word endogenous because who knows what it means usually.
What?
Will they know tomorrow?
You haven't had a colonoscopy?
No.
That's endogenous.
You know our friend, our dear friend Jeffrey.
Yes.
Okay.
Jeffrey Gardner.
Yeah. We know this. From years ago, from his book, True Monetary, what's the name of the
It's True Monetary.
True Monetarism.
True Monetarism.
Something about
but there's
true
been
monetarism.
A new version of it that's...
Jeffrey told us, he wrote there, I think it's page 43, I don't remember, but we have it marked, that the banks don't need reserves.
We know that from you.
No, he's referring to the Basel system where they don't need reserves.
And we know that.
What they do is they, under Basel, you can borrow it from the government. You need capital backing.
I'm going to use his words because he was a banker.
Okay.
I won't mention the name of the bank for 50 years. But he said that a bank knows full well that if it makes a loan, it has put into the system, even without reserves, it has put into the system enough money that they can then later get the reserves if they need it. And I think your study is showing
modeling I do as well.
Yes.
3 months or whatever. I would have thought it would have been faster. So we know that. But to me, all that's indicating is that the banks are doing even a worse thing than fractional. They're even faking the fractional reserves.
I agree with that. And the way I summarize this for my students when I put the model forward is to say that loans create deposits and the repayment of loans creates reserves. That's how the system actually works. It's all out of nothing that it's done. But that points out a point where I want to bring back in Professor Yamaguchi here on this too. What you were trying to replace this system with was highly elastic and gives money to the wrong things. You're trying to replace it with something which is fairly controlled and gives money for the right things. But that's, you're doing that into a system which is incredibly complex. And that's partly where the model that Molly, he and I both do in terms of systems dynamics comes in. You have an incredibly complex system, possibly the most complex system that's ever existed in the universe, the human financial and economic system, that has cycles which exist independent of what you might do about the monetary system and so on. But if you're then trying to feed money in at the rate that system needs it, there's a very, very high probability you'll get that rate wrong. Well, then you're going to get crises which are blamed on your control system, and you'll give power to undermine yourselves. I'm just pointing out. I'm pointing out an issue for you. Okay, I'm not saying that you should therefore do something different. But I'm saying if you're not aware of it, then the government trying to regulate the rate at which the money supplies into the system and get it right, we'll get it wrong and be blamed for it, and then you'll have a force. Yeah, that'll be one of the forces to undermine your act.
Like, what do you do when you go to war?
To be ready for this. And at that stage, I'm
thinking that'll be in someone else's hands, not ours, because we're not going to write the final sections that determine all of these rules. That's going to be done by people that are regulators and working with them all the time, and it has to be done carefully, and they have to be watched. You can't trust them to do it. As one of the people working with us said, that doesn't always work out, that they write what you want them to, they fulfill what you're trying to get. So we need to have people like yourselves, all of you, who've been in this all your lives, who are used to answering tough students and all their questions and keeping control of a student body, which is, I think, pretty challenging. We need all that help. What we do have going for us very strongly is a broad understanding of the problems with banking, however they're exactly defined, whether you want to call it endogenous or fractional reserve, it's still a problem. We look at what they did. We understand that there's speculation that they have used. They've used, but as Michael pointed out and affirmed today, that money went, that was for the benefit of the banks again. So how many of the people who bought the real estate are going to do well? Only the ones that were in it right at the beginning. How many of other types of things that they invested really work out for the investor? Not if they hold on for a long time, it's going to crash eventually with that system. Let me ask you this. Now, we want to show the video of Dennis Cassett to everybody, because we showed it yesterday, but about a fourth of the people were gone.
We need to hear Yamaguchi.
And then we have to go into Steve Walsh's.
We didn't finish Mr. Yamaguchi's.
Yeah, I know. And Professor Yamaguchi.
wants to show us a bit more on the computer. But I see that Dr. Gumhoff has the microphone and is ready to go. So if you will ask that question, and then can we show the Kucinich tape and then Professor Yamaguchi's? Is that acceptable?
Yeah.
Fair enough?
Can you do Kucinich at the end?
Yeah, that's what I think. I think we should do Professor Yamaguchi.
You prefer Yamaguchi second?
Yeah. Okay. No, right now.
We should do Professor Gumhoff has the mic. And
that's okay, he has a loud voice.
He's too big to take the mic away from.
So I have a quick question to Professor Hudson and then another one, Professor Keane. You are talking about taxing rent, and one of the rents that you want to tax is the rent of financial, the privilege that comes from the privilege of creating society's money.
Right.
Now, in economic jargon, you want to always tax things who have a supply elasticity of very low supply elasticity. Basically, their supply is not responsive to the price.
Correct.
And land is a very, very obvious example of that. Now, I'm looking for talking points from you here because I do agree with you, but if you say to an economist that you want to tax the financial sector, a standard economist, like a conventional economist, they will tell you, well, in the banking sector, you could have entry, you could have all of these things, you could have things, you could have that rent competed away. And I'm looking for talking points of how you respond to that when you get that reply.
I'm thinking of the investment banks on Wall Street, not the commercial banking, not the tax interest, because that would simply be added to the loan. But to tax the activities of the money managers, the investment banks. When you see individuals making $1 billion a year, you know there's economic rent. You know they're not earning it. This gets back to the concept of productivity. A financial officer believes that he's increasing productivity when he lowers the wages per unit of the workers by spreading the work around a attrition and then paying himself. This is what's happening today in firms. There's been a financialization of the economy. The problem really occurs. It's very much like taxing gamblers. I think that's the best way of putting it. Suppose you were to tax Las Vegas and the gambling system. We know that what they're benefiting from is the bell-shaped curve of mathematics. That's what you're seeing in Wall Street today. The gambling on derivatives, the very quick predatory trading loans. So I'm not referring to commercial bank activities. I'm referring to other financial sectors apart from credit creation, the money management sector, the bank underwriting sector. I didn't make that clear before. I know the point you're getting towards, and you're correct as to tax the economic rent at its source, not the the transfer of it into interest rate. And I think if you tax the economic rent at the source, you wouldn't have the problem of financializing this, capitalizing it into an interest payment to begin with. So I don't want to blame the banks for the failure of the fiscal system.
I want to say something in response to your request for talking points that might impress ordinary economists. And what I think you want to say to them is, yes, it's true that in a competitive system, these potential profits will be competed away. There's a question of whether we have a competitive system, but you can grant them that it will be competed away. But that's not the relevant question. The relevant question is what set of institutions will give us the greatest total social efficiency. And to take something that's a potential social surplus and compete it away is to destroy a potential value for society. So instead of having it competed away, it's better to tax it away.
And I'd say that you've got to teach them they don't know their theory of supply and demand is wrong. Competitive markets don't compete profits away. The whole theory, you've got to actually reform their classical theory out of existence. That's what I'd actually be doing to them, and that's what I'm trying to do. So I'd rather... but I think the only way to re-educate conventional economists is the same way that Max Planck argued you had to re-educate physicists who didn't understand quantum mechanics, and that was one funeral at a time.
The opening chapter of Steve's book, the first few chapters where he goes over the myths of supply and demand, are absolutely wonderful. You got to read his book.
Okay. Thank you, Mike.
I had a second point, if we have time for it. I wanted to throw out that point again that you yourself said yesterday was
doesn't
important.
Mean we have time for it.
Okay. Then I'll leave it to him.
Can you bring it up
yeah.
after?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Hang on. Okay, Professor.